This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Can you guys help me pick a filter? I don't know if I should go with XX Pro or Valencia. I want to look tan. What should my caption be? I want it to be clever. How about living with my ladies? Hashtag live. I only got 10 likes in the last 5 minutes. Do you think I should take it down? Let me take another selfie.
So when was the last time you took a selfie and posted it? And does anyone use hashtags anymore? Have you seen, or maybe you've even participated in the 2016 trend on social media? All around the world, people are posting images of themselves on social media from 10 years ago. And even though it's only a decade ago, since then, online culture has changed so much. Back then, it was selfies and pictures of your food, posting only your best life. TikTok was just a silly video platform, and Insta was simple, with pictures of sunsets and selfies of yourself with a cat filter on it. But now, is your feed just AI slop, influencers, and scams? So how has your social media feed changed over the last decade? What do you post? Have you stopped posting? And are you a part of the 2016 trend?
I guess I'll take a good selfie.
And also coming up this hour, there's been a big focus on Venus Williams and her return to tennis, but a big focus on her age at 45. So how hard is it to be fit and 45?
Let me take a selfie.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
When was the last time you took a selfie and did you post it? And how has your posting changed over the last 10 years? Maybe you don't post at all. You would have seen on social media, if you're still on it, there's a big trend called 2016, where people from all around the globe are posting pictures of their social media feed and images from 10 years ago. So what have you noticed? What has changed since then? This, I'm 26 and I don't post. I was 16 back in 2016 and it's so cringe. It was just a lot of hot takes. But the big difference now is that I no longer go online for fun. There's nothing fun. It's politics, it's AI slop, and it's all the same. Social media sites just linking to each other. And I go now once a day just to check the news and then I log off. Once I was going on to see my friends and my friends' lives. Sinead's called through from Seymour.
I've noticed that a lot of my friends who are also in their 20s as well have moved away from platforms like Instagram and TikTok. A lot of it's due to the AI content that you see, but also the fact that it's just flooded with political views now. It's not really seeing what's happening in people's lives anymore.
So has that changed your behaviour? Like, do you post anymore or do you think twice before you post?
I actually archived all of my Instagram posts and highlights recently just because I know that with AI and everything, they can use your face for different things and it just doesn't feel as safe.
I think twice even just for fun shots. You know, if you're living a moment, you're like, wow, everything about this image is perfect now. A little part of my brain thinks I should put it on social media. And then I have this internal argument with myself of why? Why does it matter? Just enjoy the moment. You don't have to post everything. And I've noticed that change as well. Erica's called through from Warragul. Good morning.
Good morning, Rich. How are you going?
I'm good. Now, Erica, am I right in that you work in the social media field?
I do. I've been actually working in that field for 10 years, since 2016.
So what have you noticed change?
So many things. I think I was actually just talking to someone this morning about this topic. I've noticed that a lot of people are just spending so much time. I work with a lot of small businesses, and I'm noticing their time suck. Like, some people are spending maybe 30 hours a week on social media. And I really strongly believe that they could be doing better things. So I think, you know, talking about selfies and filters and all of that fun stuff, I really feel like it's become a much deeper problem than I think most people realise, if I'm making any sense.
So you mean that people are just spending too much time on social media and as a result just wasting real life, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know, you see it all the time. I see it in my teenage kids and their friends. People don't sit in the moment. They capture the moment. I'm guilty of it as well.
I know. But, and yeah. Given that, in just a moment, we're going to have a chat to Stephen Conway, who's a senior lecturer in games and interactivity at Swinburne, because, Erica, you've got young children as well, you know, teenagers. And I wonder how many adults' social media behaviour has changed, even over the last, not just 10 years due to this trend, the last 4 weeks when their kids are having to get off social media. So all of a sudden we're saying, you can't be on Instagram, you can't be on TikTok, you can't be on YouTube. So then are we questioning how long we're spending on it? And as a result, are adults' social media screen time, is that reducing because we don't want to be showing off in front of our kids using something that they can't?
I hope so. I just this morning taught someone how to limit their time on social media apps, so it comes up with a little warning, which is what I've done to my kids. So I hope so. I hope that we are, because my kids will call it on my phone too much. And I do think that as adults, we're modeling this behavior and then they've had it taken away, but we're still doing what we're telling them that they shouldn't do. So, yeah, it's a funny little situation we're in now.
I think funny and little it once was. Now I think it's kind of big and ugly. It's why we're all struggling with it. Erica, lovely to speak to you. Thank you. 1-300-222-774. Have you participated in the 2016 social media trend? Or did you go back to images or posts of yourself from 2016? And what stood out to you? What was different? Was it more fun? Was it simple? Were you telling the truth? Were we being nicer to each other? Were there less influencers, less ads, less scam and less slop? Stephen Conway, senior lecturer in games and interactivity at Swinburne University of Technology. Stephen, where and why did the 2016 trend even start? Do you know?
I don't know where it first began, actually, Rochelle. I think it's a really interesting experiment, though, because what I'm seeing, and I think what your callers have alluded to, is the fact that we used to look back at our memories via photos and so on. You know, we'd have that treasured photo book, and it would be such a warm, nostalgic feeling. But here, everyone seems to be looking back and rolling their eyes. They can't believe how they used to engage with social media. I mean, I remember that sense of dread on my birthday when I would wake up and there would be 200 notifications on Facebook. Everyone's posted happy birthday. Yes. And I had to go through each one and go, thank you very much, right?
Thank you. Love heart.
Yeah, and you said, oh my God, 200 more. You know, I had a backlog of birthday messages I was responding to for months. And I think it pays heed to the fact that any new major technology generates a new environment, and we struggled to adapt for a long time, you know, so we can even think about when cars were invented and they generated suburbs, and we had to adapt to this whole new way of living where you didn't live next to who you worked with, because the factory you didn't walk to down the road, you were driving to work and you lived amongst strangers, and that creates a whole new environment. And similarly, social media created this new environment where we were trying old social rituals that just didn't work. So we were saying, oh, happy birthday, and you as the receiver immediately went, that doesn't feel right, just seeing a little happy birthday on my Facebook. And so that's died out, and pictures of food and so on. We tried all of these experiments, and I think we're finally seeing the wizard behind the curtain. And we're saying, oh, actually, we were taken a bit for a ride here. So I think that's a very interesting sea change we're seeing. I can't see any post with people going, I remember 2016 fondly. Everyone's kind of going, oh, my God.
Posting images of themselves when they looked hot, right? And skinny and buff. And so it's just a good opportunity to do that. There's a text here from Louisa and it says, hi, Rochelle. Facebook used to be a lifeline back to my friends and family in the UK. I hardly look now because my feed is just full of rubbish and I so rarely see posts from people. Isn't that interesting? I so very rarely see posts from people.
Yes.
And once it was selfies. I mean, when was the last time you sat in a cafe or a restaurant or a bar and watched someone take a photo of their food? No one does that anymore. Whereas once, were you even eating if you weren't taking a photo of your food? It has changed so much.
I remember another one that I still see a little bit on Facebook, which it comes in various iterations across the year. So I remember in the 1980s, you would get like this posted mail where it'd be chain letters and you're like, you had to fill out your name and answer a question and send it on.
Otherwise, something bad would happen.
Something bad will happen, Rochelle. And then that transmuted into email. I remember getting emails with that. And then now I see it on Facebook from like my uncle's posting saying, no one will read this, but if you do, my real friends will fill this out and da da da. And it's the same ritual, just transmogrifying again and again. And you have that really interesting, I think it's becoming a generational gap where I see a lot of eye rolling from my son when he sees this guy. And he's only 9.
Yeah.
So he never faced the dread of 500 happy birthday messages to respond to.
I've just forgotten about chain letters. You have opened a vault. I think I only received one in my life. And part of me was like, this is rubbish. And the other part of me was like, oh, my God, am I cursed? Am I going to die? I don't know what's going to happen here.
Better safe than sorry. If you're going to roll the dice, right, you might as well fill it out. You're just on the chance.
Stephen Conway is with you, Senior Lecturer in Games and Interactivity at Swinburne University. We're talking about the social media trend that you've probably seen, maybe even participated in. That's all about posting images back from 2016. So what have you noticed? What has changed in that last 10 years? Do we even post anymore? In particular, those moments, those perfect moments, those sunset moments where we have to let everybody know how perfect our lives are now. Once it was about the perfect image, whereas now you see lots of people who are posting their terrible moments. You know, here's my life at my worst and I want to share this with you as well. That's been a change.
I think trauma being shared is a real difference we're seeing. I think 2016, it was all about the superficial image. It was about wearing the mask. It was about performing the perfect identity on Facebook, Instagram, and so on. And now I think the mask is being lifted a little because I think people they've become allergic. It's like when you eat too much of something, you get the allergy. They've had too much. It's become excessive. And so they have this allergic reaction to the environment of it being all superficial and imagistic. And so now people are saying, well, I want to do the opposite, right? It's like punk music. We've had too much of the standard conventional stuff. So we want to do the resistive opposite performance. And we want to, I think, in a healthy way, find the balance of the environment.
It's been just over a month since the social media ban has come in for under 16s. When we look at what's changed over the last 10 years, what will change in the next 10 years as well? Will this social media ban change our behaviour over the next decade?
No. I mean, it's got such little impact from what I'm seeing. You know, when I talk to friends who have teenagers or are teenagers themselves, you know, my son, who I don't have on social media, but I looked at how easy it is to circumvent these policies, and it is almost absurdly easy. You know, you can either hold up a picture to the camera or just use a bit of AI to generate a face that looks older. You can use a VPN. It's so easy for anyone who spent even an hour with a computer to realize how you can circumnavigate these kinds of preventative measures. They're not. They're simply, I think, a bit of political grandstanding, and they've got no teeth, and they don't even know what they're legislating. They're trying to block Reddit, which is not at all what I think anyone would think of if they think of social media. They just don't know what they're trying to ban anyway.
Stephen Conway, have you participated in the 2016 trend? Come on, be honest.
If I did, it would just be photos of me dealing with my backlog of happy birthdays from 2015. It would just be me typing, thanks very much, Gran. I know, you know, or Jill, I know we were kindergarten friends once and we added each other. Who's added someone on Facebook recently? That's what I want to know. I haven't added anyone in years.
And because I think the trust level is something significant yes. that's changed in that time. I think if I think back to 2016, my daughter would have only been two. There would have just been lots of selfies of me and her and, you know, a rabbit filter over the top. We went crazy on filters. It was a yep. pastime in the afternoon most days. This is what you do when you have a two-year-old. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Stephen Conway, Senior Lecturer in Games and Interactivity at Swinburne University. Have you participated in the 2016 trend on social media? And what have you noticed change in those last 10 years? This, I find so many political posts now just screaming about being left or being right. It's all just politics. And another saying, what will it be like in 10 years' time? Will social media still be relevant? That's from James in Frankston.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, how hard is it to be fit and 45? There's been a huge focus on Venus Williams being here in Australia and a part of the Australian Open, with pretty much every piece of commentary going hand in hand with how old she is. So how hard is it to be fit and 45. Well, that's coming up in about 10 minutes. But unfortunately, this year, 197 pedestrians were killed on our roads. That is a huge number, and it's the highest number since 2007. On top of that, cyclist deaths, they climbed up about 32% from last year as well. Now, this is from the National Road Trauma Data. But the question is why? You know, why are more pedestrians dying? And does the growing number, the size and the weight of those huge vehicles, those huge big utes, have anything to do with this? In particular, the bull bars that are on the front of these really big cars. Milad Haghani is an associate professor and principal fellow in urban risk and resilience at the University of Melbourne. Milad, we've spoken at length about the love that we have of these big cars and these big utes, the impact that they're having on our roads. Yes. But do they have any impact on the rise of pedestrian and cycle deaths according to this new data?
Yeah, almost undoubtedly. As you mentioned in the introduction, it's not been a really good year in terms of road safety numbers. And I apologize in advance for talking about these road deaths in terms of numbers. Every death is one too many. Yes. But this is the only way we can go about describing what the situation is. So the total number of road deaths this year has pushed into 1,300, which yeah. is the highest since 2010, which basically means a regression of 15 years in terms of road safety outcomes for us. But when we look at this increasing road safety deaths, and that has been persisting for the last 5 years without any interruption, we've had increasing numbers. The increase is not being driven by necessarily car occupants. The numbers associated with drivers and car passengers, they have plateaued. They have not been going up. The increase is coming from vulnerable road users, especially pedestrians, to a lesser degree, cyclists, and motorcyclists. And as you mentioned, the number of motorcyclists and pedestrian deaths have gone back more than 18 to 15 years now. And this it is standing at one of the highest levels wow. that we have ever seen. And that's cause for concern.
So are the numbers of people being hit going up yeah. or are the numbers of people who are dying as a result of being hit going up because of the sheer weight, because of the bull bars that are on these cars? I just wonder if it was a smaller, lighter yeah. car that hit yeah. these people, would they survive?
Yep. Yep. I think in my view, the outcomes of pedestrian crashes have changed. We don't necessarily have any reason to think that more people are being hit. The fact is that we think that the outcomes of the injuries that would have otherwise been minor or severe injury have turned fatal. A higher proportion of pedestrian fatalities are turning fatal now. We have been looking at the data of crashes from Victoria, for example, and we've been looking at the rate of fatality in pedestrian crashes with sedans and large SUVs, and the rate of fatality is basically 1.6 times when it comes to large SUVs compared to sedans, 60% higher. So it is reasonable to assume that in crashes with larger vehicles, especially if equipped with bull bars, the outcome of pedestrian crashes have changed from severe injury to fatal. And if I may just mention two arguments in relation to pedestrian fatalities, because I hear them frequently. One is the population rise. This is not an artifact of population rise. We have had population increase since 2006, and we have been on a declining number of pedestrian fatalities for almost two decades. It is only recently that the pedestrian numbers have started going up. It is not a return to pre-COVID levels either. The numbers have pushed past, way past pre-COVID numbers, and it is not necessarily the artifact of people being distracted on their phone and devices. The reason for saying that is that if that was the case, if that was the primary reason, I'm not ruling it out as a factor, but if it was the main major reason, we would have seen a higher increase in younger people fatalities. Whereas the only age group that is showing a decline in pedestrian fatalities is the younger people. It is the other age groups that are showing a higher degrees of increase in pedestrian deaths, especially the older people. So it cannot be necessarily blamed on the phone use and distraction, even though I cannot rule it out. This is not the key factor. The size of the cars and the fact that they are becoming more hostile and more aggressive in pedestrian crashes, in my view, that's the key reason.
Stay with us, Millard. Millard Hagani is with you, Associate Professor and Principal Fellow in Urban Risk and Resilience at the University of Melbourne. We're talking about the alarming number of pedestrians who were killed on our roads, the highest number since 2007, 197 people, as individuals who lost their lives as pedestrians. Because Elizabeth's called through from Preston. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
That's all right.
Look, I've been trying to get something done about this for some time. You look at these big wagons and you stand in front of them and the actual front of them, where the radiator is, or would be, is at the chest height. So you get a whack there if you're in an accident, if you're a pedestrian, and you're gone. And if it's a child, that's at head height in some of them. And the other thing with these big wagons is they're talking about having batteries to save the environment. But look at all the extra material that's gone into these huge utes. And that's resources from the environment. And I just think that they're an aberration. They should be outlawed, to be perfectly honest, especially on our suburban streets.
I wonder, Elizabeth, thank you. I've had the same experience where I've stood next to one. I'm like, whoa, man, I need a stepladder to be able to even get up into that thing. Millard, a bit of pushback saying, oh, here we go again, you know, big ute bashing day. You know, this is about pedestrians not paying attention. It's not about the car themselves. Okay, so let's put aside the big car love and obsession that we have and whether or not they should be changed or outlawed or cost more, whatever. Do they need bull bars? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, bull bars were designed on big utes for regional and rural roads so that if you got hit by livestock or a kangaroo, your car was protected. Do you need a bull bar in downtown Northcote?
You absolutely do not need a bull bar because, as you mentioned, these were designed originally to protect the vehicle in case of a crash with animals, largely kangaroos, so that the vehicle remains operational after a crash so that they can continue on the journey and get to the place where they can repair the car. In city areas, there is no such risk. And I understand people coming up with an argument that, but I do visit rural and regional areas, etc. The thing is that setting aside the height of the bonnet, which is a major risk factor, if the car that is of a high level at the chest level, the bonnet is at the chest level, has an impact with the pedestrian, and if it's equipped with a steel bull bar, especially the injury impact, the outcome that it causes, the change in the severity level, it is significantly like an aggravating factor. We have seen in even low speed crashes being tested in Australia and across the world, showing that even at 30 kilometers per hour, which is a speed that a pedestrian usually survives, if the vehicle is equipped with a steel bull bar, the outcome could be fatal or very severe. And that is exactly the speed that vehicles usually drive at you know, city areas, where the outcome of a pedestrian crash does not necessarily turn into fatal. This is the difference between surviving the crash and the outcome of the crash becoming final and fatal. And that is the key factor. And these bull bars are not uncommon. A survey in Adelaide showed that almost half the four-wheel drives have them in city areas.
Although, at the same time, I cannot keep up with the text saying things like, pedestrian behaviour is appalling now, nobody looks. Another, when I arrived here 25 years ago in Melbourne, people respected the flashing red man and didn't cross. These days, people cross anytime, anywhere, jump out in front of you. It's not the distraction, it's the disrespect for road rules. I drive 9 hours a day in Melbourne and Melbourne suburbs. It's getting worse and worse and worse. That's from Nick. So if you add to it the fact that our cars are bigger and we've got these bull bars, but at the same time, pedestrians aren't doing the right thing. They're not crossing at the lights. They're distracted by their phones. Is this making the perfect storm, unfortunately?
It does make it a perfect storm. And we need to also consider that pedestrian mistakes and violations do happen. And the fact is that pedestrians are the most vulnerable road users, even though they make mistakes, even when they do. We do not want them to be punished by a death outcome. And that is the key in keeping the road environment safe. It should not be considered as a fair punishment because the pedestrian is distracted or is violating the rules or crossing at a point where they're not supposed to be crossing. When and if these crashes occur, and they are going to occur into the future as well, as a result of driver mistakes, as a result of pedestrian mistakes and fatalities, it is important that the outcome be kept as minimal as possible. Mm. Right now, we are moving towards the direction that these outcomes are so punishing. Every mistake can be punished with a death outcome. And this is something that should not be condoned by, in my view, necessarily putting the blame on the pedestrians being distracted or crossing at a point that they should not cross. Obviously, this is not to condone the violations by any pedestrian, but the thing is that the road system atmosphere should not be so hostile to punish pedestrians by death because of violation.
This message from David in Belgrave. The issue is not whether or not you need a bull bar on a car in Northcote. The question is whether the car is regularly driven out of Northcote into regional areas where the bull bar is required. You can't easily put one on and off. Let's have a chat to Greg in Williamstown. Morning, Greg.
Hi. I think the increase in larger vehicles has been a very gradual increase. So I think something else is happening. And what I notice over the course of my driving career is I think people are becoming more distracted. Maybe that's a post-COVID thing. More people driving in the right-hand lanes when they shouldn't be or don't have to be, or forgetting to turn their headlights on at night time.
Or just swerving all over the road because you know they're texting.
Yeah, so I just think there's I don't know why, but a general loss of concentration in what people are doing. And I don't know how to address that, and I guess I'd be interested to hear any comments.
What do you think, Millard?
Well, one of the factors I wrote about last week was the emergence of also touch screens in cars, which is keeping drivers more distracted than ever before. These are the things that have replaced texting while driving now, not by choice, by the force of the manufacturers, by putting these functionalities right in front of you in a big screen where you have to interact by closely paying attention and closely looking at, basically making you take your eye off the road for a sustained period of time and making everybody less safe on the road. So this is another reason more drivers and not keep attention on the road because they are forced to interact with the car in a way that is not conducive to safety. They have to have a large duration of glance at the screen, and that is not something that is good for any drivers. The effect is has been proven empirically to be comparable to texting while driving, and in some cases even worse in terms of increasing your reaction time. So that could be one of the factors.
Absolutely. And this crossing the road while looking at your mobile phone, there should be a fine for that as well. Millard, always good to get your thoughts on this. Thank you so much for your insights, and hopefully we can see those numbers come to, start to come down, because as you said, it's 197 individuals. You know, that's 197 people with loved ones and family members who are all grieving, and that number is just way too high. Millard Hagani, Associate Professor and Principal Fellow in Urban Risk and Resilience at the University of Melbourne. We've also been talking about the 2016 social media trend. Have you seen it on your feed? Have you participated? And what have you noticed over the last decade about how you interact with social media? Whether you post selfies anymore? What has changed? This social media is relevant now. Most people are do not participate. And this, give me back the days when social media was all about my friends posting their most mundane activities. Now it's just pushing dreadful news and it's all doom scrolling. That's from Mohammed.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, there's a number that you may have kept hearing when it came to Venus Williams, and that number is 45, and that is the age of Venus Williams.
She is the oldest player to ever compete in the Australian Open at 45 years of age. 84 women in the draw weren't even born when she first played singles at Melbourne Park. Quite incredible.
She first played in the Oz Open in 1998, if you would believe, and Venus lost yesterday. She's 45 years old, lost to a 24-year-old Serbian in what was a two-hour match. Sounds exhausting to me, and I'm sure it was for Venus too.
45-year-old Venus Williams wound back the clock to push a top 70 player, 21 years her junior, all the way. Serbian Olga Danilovic prevailing eventually 6-4 in the third.
So 45 years of age, how hard is it to be at the top of your game at 45? How hard is it to be super fit at 45? And what do you need to do differently? If you're 45 or over, do you find it easier? Do you find it harder to be fit? Dr. Eric Drinkwater is the Senior Lecturer of Sports and Science at Deakin Uni. And a lot of your work has a research focus on strength and conditioning practices for elite sports people. How different is it, or how rare is it, to be at the top of your game at 45? Should her age have been spoken about as much as it was?
I think that probably that there's so few athletes that manage to do it certainly makes it newsworthy. There's not that many athletes, and the ones that we do hear about certainly are the greats. So you look at someone like, you know, Martina Navratilova. She won a mixed doubles at 49. Tiger Woods, George Foreman regained a world heavyweight title at 45. So it's rare enough and newsworthy enough that it's probably certainly worth noting.
For women, does it have a different lens through it as well, especially if you've had children, if you've had time off? Do you need to look at it through a gendered lens in any way when it comes to being at the top of your game when you're 45 plus?
Well, interestingly, the biological, the physiology is that usually the decline is slower in women. Men tend to have a greater decline quicker, but I guess we tend to, the women will drop out of the sports because of those social reasons. So probably it's even more newsworthy when women do it. More for the social reasons, but the actual biology of it is that men will start to lose things like strength and power much more quickly, but don't have the social pressures to come out of their sport early.
Tennis, given it's an individual sport, how hard is it to play into later in life compared to other sports?
I think that because it's so fast, the strength and power that's required for it, so that's another one of the things that declines faster than things like your endurance. So endurance, you look at the endurance sports, and athletes tend to be older in those sports.
just because you're able to hold on to your endurance better than your strength and power. So that tennis is a strength and power sport. It makes it all the more noteworthy that somebody that's 45, and particularly a woman that's 45, is able to return to sport in that kind of, you know, really high intensity, fast sport.
What's changing in terms of technology, you know, wearable tech, how we understand women's bodies too, and their hormones? Will we start to see, and it could be men or women, but will we start to see, I mean, people do crazy things now, right, to get fit, and all kinds of chambers and boots and outfits that they put themselves into and what they do to stay fit. And I'm not even talking about elite athletes. I'm just talking about people, if you have enough money, you can do all sorts of insane things to try and increase longevity and to increase fitness. Will we start to see more and more athletes in, you know, the 40 plus?
I mean, it's certainly possible that you're right that the decreases in things like hormones and is what tends to cause the sports performance to decrease at 40. But hopefully what people start to see with this kind of thing happening is getting some inspiration from it, that the age-related declines that do happen aren't necessarily a cliff that you just fall off as soon as you tick over 40 and then suddenly that's the end, that they are slow and gradual over time. And if you exercise hard enough and you stay focused well enough, that it doesn't have to be a cliff, that that's just suddenly the end of it. So yeah, that's kind of the hope, is that people start to draw some inspiration and this can become more common. The more inspiration we see from it.
I read, you know, when we start a new year and there's lots of what will the year of 2026 be, you know, what will the trends be? And one that I happened to read was that 2026, you know, that the new definition of influence or the new definition of status will, for women in particular, will be to be muscly and to be toned, that it's less about the latest handbag and it's more about defined arms, because what that means is that you can afford the best. You can afford the personal trainers. You can afford to go to Reformer Pilates as often as you like. Do you need money? You know, is it about status? Is it about access? Or can anyone be fit into later life?
I think if you can find something that you genuinely enjoy, and I think that's probably the key to staying fit and active, particularly as you get older and those social pressures start to really accumulate, sort of through your 30s and 40s, that if you can find something that you genuinely enjoy and really want to do, I think if you can find something that you want to do, you can find ways that you can do it. But I think people start to focus too much on trying to do what's the best thing. And well, the best thing is always going to be the thing that you continue to do. So that as long as you can find something that you enjoy and you can consistently do, with a sort of small goals over time, I think those are the things that's going to keep a person moving.
Just finally, there's a text here from Joe and it says, I've taken up running at the age of 48. It's a slow progression, but I'm motivated. But my concern was heart health, so I just keep going. That's the other thing too. It's running, it's walking, looking at things not just for muscles and not just for strength, albeit good, it's for heart health. Joe's right there.
Yeah. So, and like I said earlier, that it's endurance that actually you're able to maintain that probably longer, but not to lose sight of the fact that strength is key to longevity as well. That you not only need a healthy heart, but you need the rest of your muscles to go along with it. So it's if you know that person's able to integrate some strength training into their exercise as well, that's not only going to help their running, but also help with their general health as well, because the muscle mass around your body is really important when it comes to staving off the age-related declines and the age-related health issues that come with aging.
I've started to think about how I tie my shoes now and how I bend down, because I feel like I'm at that age where you tie your shoes in the wrong direction and your back could go at any moment. So we have to think about all of those things and staying strong. Dr. Eric Drinkwater, thank you. Senior Lecturer of Sports Science at Deakin University, talking about being fit at 45. Venus Williams, she didn't make it through. However, her comeback was great and we all loved watching her out there at the Australian Open again. So how hard is it to stay fit after the age of 45? We've also been talking about the rise of pedestrian deaths. Close to 200 people or pedestrians have died, which is the highest number since 2007. And some research has led experts to believe it's got to do with bull bars and it's got to do with the size of cars. Stephen's in Kensington. Hi, Stephen.
Yeah, hello. I'm an academic and I do a little bit of urban research. And in 2014, we introduced the 40-kilometre speed limit. Mm-hmm. It took several years with the City of Melbourne. And the whole point of that is that lower speed limits also reduce fatalities and serious injuries. So the next step in many of our suburbs, where particularly residential roads that go nowhere, is to move to a 30-kilometre-an-hour speed limit, as is happening in Europe.
Now, are many areas here doing it? I know it was being trialled, I think, maybe in the city of Yarra. I'm not sure.
Yarra has been the pioneer.
Yeah.
Now, where I live in Kensington, it's a whole collection of small peninsulas which lead nowhere except for a couple of rat runs. So it would be a perfect example. But I was going to say the other thing, I have a Corolla, Toyota Corolla of the early 2000s, and in that period, Toyota built cars with a very curved bonnet to reduce pedestrian danger.
Oh, interesting.
The problem with the four-wheel drive, aside from the bull bars, is that big square high front. And I have no problems with tradies or people who do things in the country and having a four-wheel drive. But that means that the person is more likely to go under the car because of that big square front, rather than roll off.
Oh, gosh, that's confronting to think about, isn't it?
Yeah. In an ideal world, we'd have a higher tax on four-wheel drives, but that may not be politically successful given they've become so popular.
And also the other thing I found interesting, Stephen, and I don't know if there's any correlation here, but given now we've all got sat-navs in our cars, we're all being told to take the little suburban back roads and the suburban streets, and we're not sticking to the main highways and freeways and main roads anymore. We're being told to go down tiny little streets that maybe the speed limit should be lower. You know, we're seeing traffic in areas where we just once didn't. I wonder whether that's had an impact as well. Really good to get your thoughts on this. Thanks for calling through. You can keep them coming. We're talking Venus Williams. You know, we've been talking all morning and all weekend about huge crowd numbers at the Australian Open, because as we know, the world's best are in town. But how hard, how almost impossible is it to get to the top, to be the best of the best, or even just to make tennis a full-time job? And what is the reality of trying to make it, whether it be the lack of money in the early days, prize money, the money needed to travel and train, and then there's the reality that you are away from home for most of the year, and tennis is a really lonely sport. It's not a team sport. Someone who knows this all too well and a regular on this program, Rochelle Imey, Professor of Sports Science at Federation University. Rochelle, you know this because your son was on the circuit. He trained with Novak Djokovic. He was labelled a teen prodigy. Yet it was the loneliness of tennis that made him throw it all away. What's it like to try and make it to be the best of the best in tennis?
Yes, good morning. Yeah, look, it's really difficult to be a lead athlete in any sport, but I think if we're talking about tennis, you know, to make a living from tennis, you've really got to be top 150, 200 in the world. You know, if we look at Dane Sweeney, who's done great as an Australian coming through qualifying, you know, last year he was playing ITF events the same as my son. We were at some together, and even winning those events, you know, you receive $3,000 Australian. and Sweeney sort of put on social media, well, that allows me to get to the next tournament. And I've travelled quite a bit. My son, he's had to travel quite a bit by himself in Australia and overseas. And we were in China just last year, and he won through three rounds of qualifying. So there's no money in qualifying for ITF events, no umpires either. And then he won a round through the main draw. So he actually picked up an ATP point, and he had several of those. And he went and got his prize money, and it was about 300 Australian dollars for four matches that he'd won for the week. Then he had to pay Chinese tax, which is fine. And he received cash too, which is quite funny in China because there's not a lot of cash. And then he had to convert it back, and he had a couple of dollars. And he said, as an 18-year-old, I don't want to be doing this at 24 and be broke. It's really expensive to travel, to play, especially as an Australian, and it's really difficult to make a living. So Jared hung up his rackets and started playing footy again.
So as Australians, we love to celebrate our all athletes, but in particular tennis. And there was a period where we just weren't seeing Australian tennis players coming through. You know, we sort of called it a bit of a drought. You know, that's changed a little bit now, but we don't have this huge pool of really successful professional tennis athletes. Is that just because the opportunity is just too difficult? Like, it's just too financially taxing, it's too emotionally taxing. And how could you change that? I mean, is footy just easier for men and women?
Yeah, well, it's like you said, it's not just the finances, it's the loneliness and the support. And some people thrive on that. But for Jared, you know, he was travelling by himself. You know, you've got to organise your own transport in a foreign country, accommodation, meals, find someone to train with, and then play by yourself and basically with no one watching and no one providing any support. And win or lose, you sort of go back to your accommodation and sit on the bed. But he came back and played his local footy with his brother, and he had spectators supporting him. He kicked his first goal, and the whole crowd got around him. And he has coach that he doesn't have to pay for, assistant coaches, physio training, all this support that he never had as a professional tennis player. And then he even did some training with Collingwood VFL and had so much support to develop as an athlete that just wasn't there even as a top Australian tennis player.
Are the pathways different for tennis? If you think about football, soccer, basketball, that's changing dramatically. We've got academies that are opening up here in Melbourne. Lots of people, when it comes to basketball, are looking at American colleges. Is the pathway just really out there on its own with tennis? Is it trickier?
I think it's harder for individual sports than it is team-based sports. I mean, Jared gets paid more, and it's not all about money as an outcome, but Jared gets paid more playing local footy in Ballarat than what he did winning four matches as a professional tennis player in China. So, you know, and if you look at AFL, you've got to be, top 800 in Australia. Rookies probably get $100,000, $140,000 Australian a year. And you can lose every match and still get that money. Someone like Dane Sweeney, you know, he last year, I think he earned $100,000 US, so $140,000 Australian, and he was winning tournaments. So it's just really difficult financially in individual sports when you've got to travel internationally and you basically have no one in your corner.
I know there's ongoing debate in soccer, for example, around grassroots soccer and elite soccer players and who pays for what and the disparity between the two. However, it's kind of worse in tennis. I mean, some of the best of the best are fighting for more money at the Australian Open at the moment, and quite publicly they're in negotiations saying that the prize money isn't enough at the Australian Open. But many are walking away with large sums of cash. The difference between grassroots and professional, the sort of the top and the bottom, that divide is cavernous, Rochelle.
Yeah, I think with tennis, it's you've got to be really top 150 to 200. So you've got so many players trying to make a living and develop that are, you know, 150 to 2,000, and they're doing it. It's costing them at least $60,000 a year to travel. Well, that's a lot of money, and there's no guarantee at the end of it. There's no sponsorship. You know, Tennis Australia support a few players, but not the depth of players that you find in those other sort of team-based sports.
Really good to get your thoughts on this. I'm glad that he's enjoying his footy, Rochelle.
Yeah, thanks very much.
That's Rochelle Imey, Professor of Sports Science at Federation University, just talking about what it costs to try and make it, to try and be the best of the best. It's interesting, two texts side by side here. This one that says, will these sports people stop whinging about the money? If you can't make enough, then get another job, just like the rest of us. No one makes you do it. It's a lifestyle choice. Suck it up. But then another that says, so the amount of money that the Australian Open generates, why don't they feed that down to the junior kids? All of these kids hardly get a crumb or a dollar. They have to sleep in backpackers. That's from Don, who's called through. Courtney's in Essendon.
Just in regard to pedestrian deaths, I'm a driving instructor. I'm on the roads pretty much, you know, Monday to Sunday sometimes. And I feel like we're not talking about the pedestrians themselves because all I see is irresponsible road use from pedestrians all the time. And you can even ask all my students, we've got countless dash cam footage of pedestrians just stepping out when they shouldn't. Yeah. And just disobeying everything, not looking, distracted on their phones, of course. Just I just feel like we don't talk about the pedestrians enough. I completely understand in a vehicle we're driving a massive car and pedestrians are more vulnerable.
And it's not just massive cars. I drive an electric car, so my car makes no noise. And I'm very aware that pedestrian cyclists have no idea that I'm behind them. And most of the time I notice that they're doing the wrong thing, but I'm preempting that, Courtney. I'm like, okay, you don't know that I'm here, and I'm pretty sure you're just going to step out onto the road right now and not walk down the 50 metres to that pedestrian crossing. So it's not just the big cars, it's the silent cars, it's the pedestrians, it's a bit of everything, isn't it?
Of course, and it's a shared responsibility. Now, as drivers, we have to take a little bit more responsibility, of course, because of the vehicles we're driving. We're more protected, and pedestrians are not, but they still need to take responsibility.
Enjoy your car wash. Are you in the car? Like, is the thing spinning around while you're in the car?
It's just getting a quick wash before my next driving lesson.
Oh, nice.
It was.
Nothing better than getting into a nice, fresh, clean car. Thanks, Courtney. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.